Thanks for joining in today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about birds on the program today with Bill Volkert. Bill's a retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist, worked at Horicon Marsh for 27 years. And he's been watching birds for 50 years. He's written a number of books and has led many bird watching tours. So what would you like to know about attracting birds to your yard? What questions do you have about the spring migration? I hope you'll join the conversation. Maybe you've had a good experience this year as well. Number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to ideas@WPR.org. Bill Volkert, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Larry. Nice to be with you again.
When do the last migrating birds show up in Wisconsin?
Well, it'll be about the end of this month for those of us living in the southern half of the state. And in the northern half, we'll still into the first, about 2 weeks of June. We can have some of the migrants still lingering there as they wait a little bit for that season to make the nesting grounds available and get the food out there up in Canada. So, most of May is the migration time for the last of the songbirds, and then early June, that sort of tail end is heading for those birds go further north to their breeding grounds.
Which species arrive, late or the latest?
Well, we're right now getting to that point where some of the later migrants are just starting to show up. Nighthawks, I've been seeing just the last few nights, they're starting to move through. They tend to wait because they're looking for flying insects. The willow alder flycatcher, I always think of those as somewhat late arrivals, or cuckoos. And we do have a black-billed and yellow-billed cuckoo, very long-distance migrants, and not related to the European cuckoos. So those bring up some of the tail end. And even among the warblers, I tend to think of the Wilson's warblers being somewhat later, though this year it seemed those strong southerly winds pushed some of those a little bit faster than normal. And for me, when I hear the Tennessee warbler singing, that is sort of that peak of the warbler migration, songbird migration, and they've been chattering away for the last week. So we're really at the peak, and it's the vast majority of those birds that are going to be coming through our area are doing so right now.
Tennessee warblers. I don't know if Tyler can pull that one up, but it'd be fun to hear that song. He may have it.
It's a two-part song. There's a real slow beginning to it, and he'll pick up the pace for the latter half. And that last, a very accented part of the song always catches my ear. And the birds, for the most part, don't even nest in Wisconsin. It's a migrant going up to Canada.
Let's hear the Tennessee warbler. Oh, yeah. A little slow cadence to start, and then picks up for that last half.
Yeah, and that last half is really accented and sharp, and they tend to sit up higher in the trees. And that's a good song to know because it's not a very uncommon migrant. The problem is they're coming sort of that mid and latter part of the songbird migration. And most years, by the time they're getting here, the leaves are opening up.
Yeah.
And that is always the trick about looking for these small songbirds, the warblers, flycatchers, vireos, the forest birds. About the time that they begin to arrive, we get some warm weather, you get a nice rain and then some heat, and the leaves will just like double overnight. And those little 4-inch birds will start to disappear from view. And for bird watchers, they'll start to rely more on listening for a lot of these birds overhead compared to looking for them. So they're there. They just get more and more obscured as the leaves start to enlarge. And that's always the trick for enjoying that brief songbird migration of about 3 weeks in springtime is when do they get here and how fast those leaves open up? And do we get a chance to really see them and enjoy them? And this year, of course, the cool weather meant that the leaf out was really delayed. We've had other years where we had really warm weather in the latter half of April already. And by the time the songbirds get here, the leaves are half or more open. and you get very little chance to see the birds overhead, or you're peering for something that's jumping and moving around between all the dense foliage, hoping it quick pops out somewhere for a view.
Bill in Ladysmith has a question for us. Let's go there. Bill, hi.
Good morning, gentlemen. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
I live in Ladysmith in the town itself, and I have a wood garden shed next to my home, and I have a ladder tied up on the outside of it because it's too big to go in the shed. For the second year in a row, I've had a family of robins build a nest on that ladder, and I was wondering, how long does it take before the eggs hatch?
Okay, for robins, it's around 15, 16 days, and then for our songbirds, where the young essentially hatch out prematurely, naked, blind, and then they develop in the nest, there's about an equal amount of time for them to mature in the nest before they get their feathers and then fledge. So you'd have roughly a month time. So a little more than 2 weeks for the eggs to actually hatch, and another 2 weeks for the young to mature and then jump the nest. Now, there's also several days before they begin to incubate. So in other words, the female will lay an egg every day or two, and then when the clutch is complete, usually three, four, occasionally five eggs, then she'll incubate. That way they all develop and will hatch on the same day. They all will jump the nest at the same time. So you also will have several days when she first begins to lay that first egg and finally completes the clutch and then starts to incubate.
Bill, thank you so much for calling. And I think Tyler's got the robin song. Let's go listen to that. There we are.
Sort of a rolling back and forth, cheery, cheery, cheery.
Yeah.
And, you know, robin is certainly one of the most common birds for the vast majority of us, and yet they have a lot of different vocalizations, the different calls and evening song and a little variation of things. And, you know, it's a good bird to start with to learn songs, because here's a bird that you see all the time, but you may not recognize them by all the different sounds that they'll make. So it's a good one to start with and get familiar with the songs and the call notes and some of the different vocalizations. And from there, you can always build on it and start to distinguish them from others that may sound somewhat similar.
You can join in too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Abraham in Mequon up next with a question. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. In the past, I've heard people discourage the use of bird feeders and bird baths because there were bird illnesses going around. And I was curious if that was still a concern and where to get that information.
Okay, good question. Yeah, in the past couple of months, there has been outbreak of bird flu. Most of it's been in these confined poultry operations. And, of course, like anything that's epidemic, it spread through these flocks very quickly. And in some cases, they went in and what they refer to as depopulate. They essentially remove all those chickens just because they know that it's just going to keep spreading. And so they've just removed everything. We have not found widespread evidence of bird flu in wild populations. There was a report of an eagle in the Milwaukee area that had succumbed to it. And anyone who finds a extremely sick bird or a dead bird around the backyard is advised to collect that carcass, contact the Wisconsin DNR, and they can then send it to their wildlife health lab for analysis. Because there is a chance for some of these flus to move between animals and people. We don't have evidence that this one necessarily is causing any illness for people, but still advised that you put on rubber gloves, wash your hands real well after you've handled the bird, bag it up, freeze it, and then contact DNR, and they can do the analysis. You may also, late in summer, find evidence of birds dying from West Nile virus. We certainly know that that cycles, especially around August. And in wintertime, the salmonella is another disease that can spread around bird feeders. So here's the situation with bird bats and bird feeders is we like to bring in the backyard. We do it for our enjoyment. The birds take advantage of that. It's not necessary or critical for birds most of the time, but it certainly is convenient. But the important thing is sanitation. And I think we all know that from the human epidemic that we've been experiencing here, you want to keep things clean. You want to make sure that you have some disinfecting. And if we do find any evidence that birds are dying around a backyard, you may want to shut that down, disinfect, basically warm water and bleach, and give it a little bit of time. That's that social distancing. Let the birds spread out. But at this point, there's no real reason to have to shut down bird feeders or bird baths. There was a little bit of caution at first, but we don't think that this right now, this particular strain of bird flu, is very widespread among wild bird populations.
There you go, Abraham. Thank you so much for calling. Diane in Oconomowoc. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. For about 10 years now, I've had bobolinks that are nesting in a 20-acre field that we own next to our home. And I was just wondering if the same families keep coming back year after year. They're just such wonderful birds to listen to and to watch.
First of all, you're very fortunate to have the bobolinks, and I certainly hope you maintain a nice open field environment for them. This is a bird population that has been declining. And they're also another one of our later migrants. Usually we're well into that second week or even third week of May before they show up, because they're coming all the way back from the Argentine Pampas. Mm-hmm. So they're going down to those far southern grasslands. That's a long flight for them.
Yeah.
Is it the same ones? Most likely, because if you think about it from an aerial view, there are these sort of patchwork and mosaic of where these good grassland habitats are available and whether some birds are finding it randomly, just flying overhead and finding good habitat, or others zeroing in on them. It's always a challenge to know who's who among these bird populations. And of course, the only way scientists can distinguish that is by actually capturing and marking individuals. And that's where we get some of this information from about birds returning to the same place each year. So that is certainly a trend that some of the same birds are coming back, and perhaps the young are imprinting on that and coming back as well to those areas. And some of those may also be, as they find that the area is already kind of saturated with a breeding adults, some of those may be floaters and spread out a bit and may then pioneer into new sites that might be available or have been managed for those birds, which helps to spread the population out. But all those bobolinks out there, all the males look alike. So without any way of distinguishing or marking individuals, there's a little bit of guesswork in that. But yeah, no doubt there are some individuals that are coming back each year to that very site and taking advantage of it. And thank you for managing good grassland habitat for those birds, because I said that is a declining population. They do need help, and they've got one heck of a long flight.
And Tyler's got the bobolink song. There it is.
It is just a chatty, bubbly, real happy song.
It is indeed.
And it carries a long ways over these open fields. So oftentimes these birds are heard before they're seen. And they will sit up on a bit of a perch when the males want to sing, or they'll do an aerial display. They'll flutter around and call in flight. But once they drop down, if they're not on a prominent perch, you may hear them and not see them. The name bobolink is given to that call. People try to give a little bit of a phrasing for it, bobolink-a-link-a-link, something like that. So the name is stuck as a way to describe it, but it's certainly far more musical than we can describe.
Yeah, for sure. Bill Volkert, our guest, retired wildlife educator, as we look at the wonderful world of birds here in Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Bill Volkert, retired wildlife DNR educator and naturalist. Great to have him back. Join in with your questions at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Nikki in Milwaukee emailed to ask if Cardinals have a different song for morning versus afternoon.
A number of birds that will have a somewhat morning song, or even for the robin, what I refer to as an evening song. So there is a little bit of a difference. Even black-throated green warbler tends to have a particular song in the morning and then change a little bit in its vocalization. So, yeah, there is little bit of difference perhaps from the time of day. And as I said before, even with the robin, if you listen carefully to the cardinals, there's a lot of variation. And even among individuals, some of them will have a little bit of a different twist on the song compared to others, perhaps to distinguish them from their neighbors. So, yeah, it's a great world just to listen to birds.
It sure is. I think Tyler's got a cardinal for us, too.
Sweet, sweet, cheer, cheer, cheer.
Yeah, I love that song. Hear that every morning when I'm out on my morning jog. And it's always a nice way to get yourself going in the morning.
Oh, yeah.
Mark in Wisconsin Dells, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. I just wondered, when I was a kid, the lake that I lived by used to have a lot of American bitterns in it, and I haven't seen one since I moved back here in 2006. I'm wondering, did I scare them away?
American?
Well, probably not, but bitterns seem to have shown a bit of a decline in their population as well. It's not an easy bird to census. The breeding bird surveys that we conduct do a good job of keeping an index on the songbirds and forest edge birds, but because they're done off of roadsides, they don't do well for covering birds of the wetland environment. And so the bittern, first of all, we don't have real solid long-term data. They tend to space out pretty well on some of the bigger marshes. The best way to really find them is the evening call, especially when that air is nice and still. They have a lower bassy call that can carry for a long, long distance. It's described as an unka-chunk, and it's sort of this deep pumping sound. So that's probably the best way to determine if they're there. And if you anyone's familiar with the field marks and coloration of the bittern, it's a brown bird, very striped. It's a small member of the heron family, a little chunky mid-sized heron. And these darker brown stripes on a tawny tan-colored body. Well, one of their favorite things is if they get frightened at all, they'll put their head straight up and then they'll just show that striping and blend in with cattails and rushes.
Uh-huh.
And they can just disappear from sight. Or I've watched them at Horicon Marsh quite a bit. You occasionally will see them sitting on the edge of cattails, get a sight of it. They walk back 2 or 3 feet and they can disappear from view. On some of the larger marshes, the best way that I find to look for them, if I want to find bitterns, American bittern, on some of these large marshes, just have a place where you can get an overview over the open cattails and just sit there for a good half hour. And especially now when they're moving around, just wait for one to get up, fly across the open, and then dive into the cattails and disappear from view. You also want to check your field guide for the plumage of the immature night heron, which looks a little bit like the bittern. He lacks the black on the wingtips, and the bill is more blunt and rounded, where the bittern is quite a pointed, slightly upcurved bill. So those are good field marks. It's a very secretive bird. It's a great one to see, though, if you're lucky enough to.
Yeah, for sure. Mark, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Charles emailed to ask you to discuss the migration of loons and pelicans On Whitewater Lake, he's had spring loons for a couple of years, and this year they seem to have had six. And a flock of penguins. A flock of pelicans. He's sure pelicans migrate up the Mississippi, but of course they're well east of the Mississippi, and wondering about that.
Okay, first I'll start with the loons. Loons will go down to the southern states and the Gulf Coast, and they'll hang out there for the winter time and make their way north. They're a pretty early migrant. I've already seen loons in early spring when lakes are barely one-third or half open.
Yeah.
You still have ice on a portion with a loon sitting right on the open water. So they'll be moving north as fast as that ice is receding. I occasionally will see loons overhead, and they'll be flying and even make a big sweep or a circle. And I think maybe what they're doing is seeing just how far is their open water where they can land and fish as they're trying to inch their way further north to the breeding grounds. So, yeah, loons, as they're coming north, they sometimes can stack up a little bit on some of the lakes. I know Madison area, the bird watchers there sometimes reported some big numbers of loons that will arrive early, and then others will come in. And as the lakes further north remain iced over, numbers can build up a bit. Sometimes it's a solitary bird out on an open lake. And then, as I say, it's, you know, as that ice makes the feeding grounds available, they'll slowly start to make their way north into the northern half of Wisconsin and Canada. That's the primary breeding ground. Loons seem to be doing fairly well, and we've actually seen some new pairs showing up a little further south from their range in central Wisconsin. So looks like loons are at least maintaining their numbers or even increasing slightly.
I've seen up a 70 on Lake Monona in Madison, and a friend said he counted over 100 on as he stood up on the Monona Terrace, where you get up there high, and he had binoculars, and he counted over 100.
Oh, yeah. It's a rare occasion, but, they can really stack up at a certain time of the year. It's quite a sight. In fall type, it seems that a lot of the loons from northern Wisconsin, southern Canada, come down, and then we'll move over into Lake Michigan to feed and then head south. Pelicans will spend their winter along that Gulf Coast and over toward Florida and the southern Gulf states. Now, pelicans, everybody knows them from Florida, and we have both the white pelican and brown pelican. Brown pelican stays south. He's always around the Gulf Coast, the coastal areas of Central America, and the northern half of South America. The white pelicans, a lot of people are surprised that if you get out into the Central Plains and out even to Yellowstone Park, that's the nesting area. So it's in that prairie area and up into the central prairie provinces of Canada. So as they're going north, if you think a little bit about flying from, say, Florida to North Dakota, you've got a cross over the Appalachians or even the edge of the Ozarks and the forested areas there. That's not a good place for a pelican. So what they'll do is actually shift across the southern states and Gulf and come up the Mississippi and then spread toward the west. Now, the population of pelicans has been moving east. Over the decades, we've had sightings of individuals in small numbers all through the 60s, 70s, and 80s in Wisconsin. Every other year, every 3 years, we'd have a stray one. The assumption is that these were probably young ones that weren't old enough to breed, just heading up to the breeding grounds to hang out for the summer, get blown off course, find a place to hang out. There's no rush to get anywhere. And so we'd have these stray sightings. Starting in the mid-90s, they were hanging around Wisconsin in bigger numbers. Seems to be have something to do with some of the droughts out in the prairies and birds abandoning those colonies. And they began to nest in the Green Bay area. In the late 1990s, early 2000s, we had a colony start at Horicon Marsh, and more they've been nesting in different areas on Lake Winnebago, the upper lakes there, eventually the Mississippi River. And people are starting to see more pelicans in places like, just recently reported from Sheboygan up in Door County. Not all of those are breeders. It takes several years for them to mature and actually begin to nest. So just because you see a flock of pelicans hanging out on a lake does not necessarily mean that they're nesting. They nest on open islands, so they'll nest on the ground. And, yeah, we're starting to see pelican becoming actually a fairly common bird in Wisconsin. And they are big.
Yeah, they are.
A wingspread even bigger than bald eagles. Bald eagles about a 7-foot wingspread. Pelicans is 9 feet.
That's amazing.
It's a heavy bird. Yeah, they're going to be up 25, 30 pounds, and it takes quite a bit of effort to get a big body like that off the water. But they are a graceful flyer, and they actually do a lot of soaring because it's just so much work to flap and get yourself up. So they look for a good wind and nice rising air currents.
And we've got the song of the pelican.
The grunt.
The grunt. Yeah. There it is.
And they do that around the nesting colony, so most of us don't hear that.
So,
if they get a little agitated around the nesting colonies, they'll make that noise. Most of the time, they're just sitting on the water and either resting or doing some fishing.
That's a fun grunt. Shelley in Reeseville, your turn. Hi, Shelley.
Yeah, I have 10 acres up near, it's Pelican Lake address, Pelican Lake, Wisconsin. So we're in the woods, but I hear a bird. It's just the most beautiful sound. It sounds like somebody playing a flute, like a soft melody of a flute. And you only hear it in the evening at dusk. And then you might hear it early in the morning, but other than that, then I usually don't hear it anymore, but never can see it. Never have seen the bird, so I don't know what it is, but I just wondered if you knew what it was.
Okay, there's a couple of birds that have a rather flute-like a song. Probably the most common or noteworthy one is the wood thrush, and that's described as an eole. In the northern half of Wisconsin, we also will get the hermit thrush, a close relative. His will start with usually a couple of about three little introductory notes and then a nice little rolling musical flute-like a vocalization. And then in the bogs or swamps, we get another close relative. These are all the thrushes. And by the way, the thrushes are relatives of the robin. And that would be the veery. And the veery gets his name from the song. It sounds like a nice little rolling, soft musical. Veery, 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 veery. And it also has a kind of an echoing to it. But these are all the thrushes.
Let's hear that. Let's hear that wood thrush. Tyler's got that one. There.
Eole.
That's pretty cool. A nice song.
I'm curious if that's the one she was hearing.
Is that the one you were?
No. Nope, that's not the bird. I've heard.
Well, we've got the veery. Let's listen to the veery. What do you think, Shelley?
Nope, that's not it.
And if Tyler can find the hermit thrush, that would be my last guess, especially for the northern half of Wisconsin.
All right, well, here comes the hermit thrush.
Maybe that sounds a little bit kind of more maybe like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got a couple little, I always think of about 2-3 introductory notes and then rising up and a little bubbly finishing off.
Yeah, and it's a real soft, though. It's like a real, like a slower motion sound of a flute.
And there are individual differences among birds. And even if you move around the state, birds perhaps in one corner might sing a little different than others. These are forest birds. Or as I said, the veery is really in the bogs or lowland forests. And yeah, they like to hide back there. The voices carry a long ways, but you know, if you look in the book, you'll see that they're brown birds, a little speckling on the breast, good camouflage. So it's not the brilliant plumage, but it's all about the song.
Shelley, thank you.
Some of the best music in nature.
Yeah. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Tanya, let's go to you on Stevens Point. Hi.
Hi. So I moved up here about 25 years ago, and I live around a lot of farm fields, but I do have 10 acres of woods. And I had two cardinals. And so over the years, this last year, I've seen 6 sets of cardinals in my yard. Are those babies from the others, or just more coming?
What do you think, Bill?
I'm sorry, there's a little bit of an echo in the call.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, she had a pair of cardinals, Tanya did, mm-hmm. and then now there are suddenly several pairs, and wondering if they are, you know...
the young of the year already?
Yeah.
This is a little early for the young. The Cardinals is a year-round resident, so they can begin at least establishing a territory pretty early in the year, but they also wait for food to become available before they begin nesting. So I would think it's maybe a little early for the first young to be out. If they were, they'd be still young fledglings. I think she just has several pair in the area that are getting ready to nest or beginning or ready nesting, and maybe a little competition between them for their nesting territories.
Yeah, and you had a question or a comment about the blue heron, Tanya?
Yeah, and I'm not sure if that's what I'm seeing, but I have just a little pond in my yard, and my cat got old over the years, so maybe he feels more comfortable, but he keeps coming back every year, about 3 years now, and it looks something like a blue heron. Is that something that would be, it's not very big, though. Is that an
interesting
or what would that be?
Sure. Great blue heron, it's a pretty appropriate name. It is the largest of the North American herons. And, you know, this is a bird that's going to stand 3.5 feet tall. And he's got this curved neck. So if he stretches it out, he'll be even a little taller yet with those long, lanky legs. There's a smaller relative that's roughly the size of a crow. That's the green heron. And the green heron has a real kind of a squawk. Skiow is usually how they'll describe the call of it. And they tend to be more of a individual nesters or a couple of pair in a loose colony, where great blue herons are colonial nesters. So they'll look for isolated areas and they'll build their nests. They'll be 2 feet across up in the treetops. And there oftentimes will be some pretty good sized colonies, 10, 20 pair. Around the Mississippi, there are some colonies of 200 to 400 pair. They always look for large, isolated areas. And then they'll fly out to feed, of course. When we were doing our studies on colonies on the Mississippi years ago, we were noting that these birds were flying 12 to 15 miles commonly to go out to feed, with some of them going as far as almost 20 miles distance. When you got hundreds of birds, they all got to spread out and look for their own little fishing area.
Let's hear the green heron.
Yeah, described as scowl.
Yeah.
Kind of a throaty, guttural one, where the great blue heron is just a real deep squawk.
I think we've got that one. Yeah, they don't sound too much alike at all.
No, and not very musical either.
No.
And, you know, green herons, when you see them fly overhead, at a quick glance, they can almost look like a crow silhouette. They're about that size, but he has a more steady, slight arched wing beat and a pointed bill. So, yeah, they're not too uncommon to see them flying over as they're going from, say, nesting area or roosting site out to feed somewhere along a creek, a stream, or edge of a pond.
Tanya, thank you so much for calling. Let's go to Scott in central Wisconsin. Hi, Scott.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'm interested in a whippoorwill. I mean, I'm 60. I'm from central Wisconsin, but my parents lived up by Lake Tomahawk. And, you know, early in the morning, you'd hear the whippoorwill. And I never seen one. And I talked to my aunt, who's 96 now, and she said she never seen them. I mean, I know they're a night bird, but, you know, I'm just interested in knowing more about them.
Well, seeing one is really going to be a challenge. So I'm not surprised that you haven't seen them. I've only stumbled across them once or twice to actually get a good view of them. Check a field guide, you'll see that they've got this really nice brown mottled speckled back. It looks like leaf litter, and they do nest on the ground. So they'll be resting during the day and very well concealed and camouflaged. And so they come out at nighttime, and that's when they'll start to sing. So, yeah, if you want to detect whippoorwill, it is done almost exclusively by sound. this is a bird where numbers have been declining. They have been receding in Wisconsin. There is still a population in the western part of the state. So from about Prairie du Chien going north in those areas, there's a population. I heard reports of a small population up by Two Rivers. There are a few, say, enclaves of them still around. Incredible, beautiful song. But yeah, if you want to see one, I would say that would be more just plain luck of stumbling across one and flushing it. Unlike, say, the nighthawk, which is its very close relative, right now they're migrating through Wisconsin, and you'll see them around dusk flying overhead, and you'll hear them calling. I had two of them last night just before sunset, and that's just a buzzy little call. Both of those birds have been declining, and there is a real concern for their populations.
Yeah. The whippoorwill, I always loved that song on... Yeah, that
I've had a few people tell me that, oh, I hear them by me and they go all night and I find it almost annoying. It's like, no, this is such a beautiful song and becoming somewhat more rare in our woods. Be happy that you've got them and you can hear it. Yeah, it's just a beautiful sound. And to me, this is really the other concern I think we need to have over the loss and extinction of birds. It's not just the idea that something like that may not exist, but the idea that we would never hear it again in the wild. And this is really something we've got to keep going. It's the music of nature.
Scott, thanks again. Appreciate your call. Mike in Minocqua, your turn now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. We had the pleasure. We had a little, Bill was talking about the little 4-inch birds that nest way up high in the trees, and we had an old world warbler, a little ruby-crowned kinglet that came in and took advantage of the fact that the sun really blazes on the back of our house, which faces west, and he could get a lot of food there. He was sitting in a burning bush, and he has a little red crest or crown that he can raise up from time to time, and he was, I think, seeing himself and doing that display, and also at one time seemed to be moving to the music on a little radio we had on the counter by that window. But we got to see him for about 3 days in a row, and he came in regularly in the afternoon, and it was really fun to see him.
Yeah. I think Tyler's got that.
Ruby crown kinglets come through here in that latter half of April, and sometimes will linger in the early part of May. The males come through first, then the females. The male has that a brilliant ruby crown, which is usually concealed unless he gets a little excited, or especially if he sings, he'll raise that up. I've already had the birds in the hand when we're doing bird banding, and if you brush the other feathers together over the head, it totally hides that red. If you just separate a bit, it is truly a brilliant ruby red. And by the way, those birds are so small, they make chickadees look big. It is a very tiny bird. They're going all the way up into Canada to nest, so it's about 3 weeks that they're passing through here, and then they move on.
And we've got that song Tyler has.
What? CCC? Look at me, look at me, look at me.
Oh,
so that's one of the little phrases we use to remember that song, and that one for me works very well.
Yeah.
CCC, look at me, look at me, look at me.
Yeah.
Very bubbly little song for a tiny bird like that.
Thanks very much for that call. Bill Volkert, our guest today, retired wildlife educator and naturalist. Great to have him with us. You can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mealer. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at the world of birds here in Wisconsin, Larry Mealer here with my guest, wildlife educator Bill Volkert. Thanks for joining in today. Questions? Call us at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Steve in Waupun has a question for us, so let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
My wife and I have a cabin on Lake Manson up between Rhinelander and Tomahawk, and 2 weeks ago we saw a pair of Megansers, and that's a bird I have never seen before. Can you tell me of something about that bird.
Sure. There are three species of mergansers in Wisconsin. The largest of them is the common merganser, all white body on the male with a nice green head. From a distance, I know people have confused that with a loon. The female is going to be a gray body with a reddish-brown head. The red-breasted merganser has a speckled breast and a little ring around the neck and kind of a little bit of a brush cut or hairdo. There's the feathers sticking off the back of the head. They're almost the same size. We'll sometimes see some pretty good flocks into late fall and occasionally throughout winter on Lake Michigan. They'll migrate into the inland areas as they're going north. The female of that bird, the red-breasted merganser, looks somewhat similar to the common merganser. It's just the red from the head and the gray body, they blend together rather than being a nice cutoff line. The other one is the smallest of them is the hooded merganser. The male is just spectacular.
Yeah.
He's got this hood that he'll raise up, the feathers. It's rimmed with black with a large white patch. It's got these great stripes down the upper part of the breast or on the sides of the breast, and a black-white bird. It's a much smaller bird. All of these are cavity nesters, and the hooded merganser has been nesting more and more into the southern part of Wisconsin and will use wood duck boxes. I've got one. I just was out this morning around sunrise, and I had one flying overhead. I could hear it from its little grunt as it was flying by, and I've got my wood duck boxes out. Occasionally, I will have them nest in there, so I'm hoping that maybe they're in there already at this time of year. So those are the three that we have. They're all fish-eating ducks. So where you think of duck as a normal or typical duck bill, like a mallard, this is a pointed little bill and actually has serrations, like little tooth-like edges on it. You know, birds don't actually have teeth, but this is as close as you get. And that's because they want to hang on to those slippery little fish. There's only one more species of merganser in the world that is over in Eurasia. That is the smew, and it's actually the counterpart. It replaces the hooded merganser in Europe and Northern Europe and Asia. Those are the fish eaters.
Love seeing the hooded and the common mergansers on Lake Monona in spring, of course. Which song do you like the best of those mergansers?
Oh, I like it of the hooded merganser.
Yeah, I do
it
too.
It does not sound like a duck at all. And a lot of the hunters refer to them as sawbills, which is a pretty good name.
Yeah.
Sounds more like a bullfrog, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. It's a
more like a frog. And that's one of our ducks.
Steve, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. Ingrid in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Hi, Ingrid.
Hi. We have a home along the Bay of Sturgeon Bay, or Little Sturgeon Bay, which is along the Bay of Green Bay. And this is the first year we've noticed a pair of kestrels in the trees right in our area. And with that, not many other birds. And we've seen the kestrels catch a few in the air, and we've also seen the remnants of them. And we're just wondering how territorial they really are, and if this is a pair that will now come back year after year.
Yes, it's possible that they will come back. There has been quite an effort to provide some nesting sites for the kestrel. It is a cavity nester, and you can actually use a box just a little smaller in size from that of a wood duck box. I know people who have attached them to silos and barns. That was actually a not too uncommon nesting site for kestrels with some of these older semi-abandoned buildings. But as we've gone from the old wooden barns to the steel closed-in buildings, they've lost access there. They will also use boxes that are attached to, say, power poles, places like that. And so there's been quite a concerted effort to try to help them because this was a population that we were seeing declines. I'm not sure what the long-term population trend has been, but I will say that this past fall and winter, I was seeing more kestrels than I have in a number of years. And whether it's just that there were more birds out there or maybe they were just concentrating because of a high rodent population that there was a lot of food. So, but it's nice to see those birds around. And, yeah, it's very likely they'll come back. And take a look at plans for a kestrel box, unless they're using a natural cavity, like an old woodpecker hole or something. You can certainly aid them that way.
Ingrid, thanks a bunch for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Tom in Crandon next. Hi, Tom.
Hello. We've got a red start. It's been for 2 years now we've seen this, a red start flying and perching on our couple of our windows on the east and southeast part of our cottage. They don't seem to be flying into the window, but they hang on the little rail, you know, between the panes, and then they'll flutter up against the glass. And I'm wondering if that's a competition for a mate or what that is.
It's what I refer to as shadow boxing. It's a little unusual to hear a red start doing this, but a number of different birds will see their reflection in the glass, think that's another male, and they'll try to do a little battle to chase him out of the neighborhood. And probably the most common one, which can get a little annoying, is the robin, occasionally cardinals, and even goldfinches are the most common birds that will fight with their reflection in the glass. I've even had white-breasted nuthatch that will sit on a chair and see its reflection and fan its tail, droop its wings, and fan a little bit back and forth. And I just recently had to move a little piece of furniture on our deck. I had a tufted titmouse. He wasn't fighting at the glass, but he would look into that and then posture. So, yeah, they're seeing their reflection, and that's the problem. Now, if anybody gets a robin or a cardinal that starts doing that and fluttering, it can get quite annoying, both for the bird. He's wasting a lot of time and energy for no good, and even frustrating for the homeowner. The big thing is to try to break them that habit as early as you can so they don't become too obsessed. I've had a robin here that I have tried in the past, every trick there was, and I could not break him of it. I mean, it was just an obsessive compulsive behavior of this bird. We tried all kinds of therapies, and it just did not work. And I just had to wait for that season to pass a couple of weeks there before he finally got tired of it and was further into the nesting season. He gave up. But, yeah, that, it can be quite frustrating. Interesting to hear, though, for a red start doing this. But that's a very colorful bird, very black with a brilliant orange fanned across the tail and on its sides. And they'll actually fan that tail in posture with that to show those colors. The male is black and orange. The female is gray and yellow, showing the same pattern.
Hmm. Tom, thank you very much for calling. Jim in Camp Douglas, what's on your mind?
I've got some birdhouses out, and I've got some bluebirds and some tree swallows that would like to reside in them, but I've got some wrens that don't want them to do that. So I was wondering what I can do, because they'll build either over the top of the nest, or in some cases they'll take and bail out everything that they've, the bluebirds and the tree swallows have put in, and clean it out for them and then make their own nest.
Yeah, wrens are, you know, they're cute little birds, but they can get quite aggressive when they're looking for a nesting site. And they will also pack those little twigs into a number of cavities, but only use one. I had a neighbor 1 year who had built wren houses. He put them up, in all of these in his tree. And he said, oh, I had 16 wren boxes in a single tree, and everyone had a nest in it. Well, all he did was have that one pair so busy packing sticks in it, it still was only one pair that nested. So I think if you, especially Camp Douglas area where you have a large open grassland area, I think the trick here is to add some more boxes. Spread them out far enough so the wren isn't going to try to pack them all full and claim every one, but give some alternative sites so the swallows might be able to nest some distance away, bluebird somewhere else. It gets a little harder to do that in smaller confined areas where they're all battling for a single nest site. But, yeah, I think that would might be one of the answers is add a few more boxes, give some alternative sites, and see if we can't satisfy all of them. Also, if you're looking for good information on bluebird nesting, the website for the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin has great information on how to build boxes, how to manage them, maintain them, and how to identify the difference of the eggs from wrens to even chickadees, tree swallows, bluebirds, and so you know who's using your box and how to monitor those.
Jim, thank you very much for calling. Trevor in Winona, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Trevor.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Thanks. I was calling because I was wondering if you had ever heard of a cinnamon teal, first off.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You know anywhere that they're, like, native to? Because I shot one when I was younger, when I was hunting, and I don't know if they're just not that common or if there's like a place that they're from.
Sure, that's a great question. They're not that common in Wisconsin. And when there are sightings of cinnamon teal in Wisconsin, especially springtime, it's a stray, and bird watchers will sometimes travel quite a distance just to get a view of it. It's a western duck. That's why we don't see them here. And there's also a population all the way down into Chile. And so, yeah, for teals, these are the smallest of our ducks. The most common one we have is blue-winged teal. It nests in Wisconsin. Green-winged teal tends to nest a little further north. And then cinnamon teal is a western counterpart for these.
Trevor, thank you. So I know Trevor has a question about the grouse population, and we'll get to that after we we'll take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll get back and talk about grouse populations in the state with our guest, Bill Volkert. And, of course, you can call with your questions or email as well. Call at 800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. The rose-breasted grosbeak song. A great way to start the last portion of our program today. Larry Mueller here with birding expert Bill Volkert. Always great to have him come by as we talk spring bird migration and lots of other things relating to birds. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. And we've had a number of people ask, how does Tyler do that? Or where does he get those bird songs from so quickly? And he uses the Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. You can go online to that site and hear those songs whenever you want to. So it's a kind of a great addition to the program when Bill's with us. Bill, it's always fun, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. Thank you. This is the All About Birds is the website that he's using. And there's another very good tool, which is put out by Cornell, and that is called Merlin, named after the little falcon, which is a little larger than our kestrel and smaller than the peregrine falcon, also Merlin the Magician. And it's a free download. You can put it right on your cell phone, and then you can load what are called bird packs. And the bird pack is basically a checklist, and they are developing checklists for countries all over the world. You can download either the entire United States, continental U.S. and Canada, or just the upper Midwest and narrow it down to our region. You'll have right on your phone a field guide showing numerous illustrations of the different birds. The songs will be there. You can listen to them. And there's even a new app that's been included, which is Song ID. You can take your phone, hold it up, capture that bird song, and if we're using a little artificial intelligence, it'll try to identify that for you. You don't even need to have an ornithologist walking with you if you can get that app and be able to capture those bird songs. So it is a really handy tool to have, and I'd really recommend it for anyone who's got interest in our birds.
And our caller, just before we broke for news, asked about the grouse population in the state.
Yeah, grouse, we have known for a long, long time, have a 10-year population cycle. So every 10 years, they hit a high population, and then they'll drop low again and then back up. And it's usually a 1 or 2 or 3 years after the decade is where we're reaching that high point. So there is this fluctuation as we try to map their numbers up and down. It is somewhat cyclic. We don't really understand the full reason and influences for those cycles, but it's been certainly tallied and observed for a long time. The problem has been the last couple of times, last few decades, as we go to that peak, it hasn't been as high as it's been in the past. and whether that is, say, changes in forest habitat. We do know that some of our northern forests are maturing, and grouse like, especially for the drumming, nesting, and secure areas, they like to some of the younger forests, those aspen groves. And so we need to keep those actually rotating. And I know that there is a real concern over clear cutting of forests, but that's a good way to rejuvenate aspen and use it for pulp. And that provides really good grouse habitat about 5 to 10 years after a harvest. As the trees mature more, they choke out the aspen, becomes more from a young forest to an older growth. It certainly provides great habitat for another group of wildlife, but the grouse tend to lose out. Is it just changes in habitat? Are there other causes? We're not sure. And this is typical for biologists. We first then tally and keep track of and monitor our wildlife population to see how they're doing. If we're seeing declines, it becomes much harder sometimes to identify what the cause is and what we can do to rectify it. But that's certainly the effort of conservation and wildlife management.
Let's take another call. Jamie in Algoma. Hi, Jamie.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. We have a female mallard who has decided to build her nest on a half whiskey barrel on our driveway, and she doesn't seem to be too disturbed by us. We try to give her her space and not scare her, and so far she tolerates us very well. My question is, when those poor little ducklings hatch, I don't know how we're going to get them to water. We're about 2 blocks from Lake Michigan, but there's a really steep drop-off, probably 20 feet down to the water. I don't think the little guys want to tumble over that. Is there any way to relocate them once they hatch?
I would not do that. Let the mother take them to the water, and they may just tumble down. Wood ducks will nest up in either wood duck boxes or old cavities in trees, and commonly they'll be 10 to 20 feet up. We've actually watched them as much as 60 feet up. First day of life after they hatch out, mother calls for them, they climb to the entrance, and they leap out, and they basically tumble to the ground and bounce a little bit. So, let her just simply lead them to that water. That's going to be safety for them, and then looking for the food there. Right now, mallards, as you've indicated here, they're pretty adaptable. They'll nest even in urban, suburban areas. And as they take their young from the nest site to then the feeding grounds into water, that can be a bit of a hazard for them. And so we have to give them a little bit of space and a little bit of room. And the big thing is, don't separate the family, because mom is just going to simply be walking along and calling very lowly, real low notes, trying to keep that family together. She just waits for the young to keep up. If you separate the family, she's not going to go back to save everyone. She just hopes that everybody else can catch up. So allow her to keep that group together and take them to where she needs to.
There you go, Jamie. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. David in Jackson County, your turn. Hi, David.
Hello. I love your show. Been listening for years. I feel like I've gotten another college degree from you, Larry.
Thank you.
But I'm a semi-retired environmental engineer that UW grad out of Madison, and now I'm living with my wife fully off grid in the kind of in the middle of the tension zone, north driftless region. So all of a sudden, all these birds you're mentioning, we've got a lot of them here, and it's and there was nothing when we moved in, and we just kind of made it into a preserve. So I would like to put a shout out to a couple of Wisconsin programs, the Managed Forest Land program that we got into, mm-hmm. that kind of allowed us to keep this land for nature and birds, and they're really loving it. And I think we could put a lot more land into some kind of environmental use, like the Managed Forest Program. Also, the Master Naturalist Program we took was amazing. It was 5 days at Beaver Creek Reserve, and that was a beautiful program, and I'd love to see that offered more to people, to landowners. Because I think a lot of this land, especially in our tension zone, could be converted back to nature without too much, financial effect. But I don't know. This could be a topic for another program. But I'm just saying the veeries and everything, they're back, and whippoorwills and everything. You just got to kind of let them be.
Well, David,
well,
thanks
so
much
for doing that work. Yeah, excellent. I really am happy to see somebody who's doing some good wildlife and habitat management on their property and really seeing the results of that. You know, there's a lot of public lands out there for wildlife, and those are, you know, our wildlife areas and refuges are intentionally managed for that. But yet for the percentage of our land base, it's pretty small. And so we really rely a lot on private lands and for people, these landowners, to be able to do something for these birds and benefit them. We know a lot of our bird populations are declining, and there's some serious concerns for a number of them. I try to be an optimist. There's a lot of things that give me cause for concern these days, and I do worry about the fate of some of our bird populations. But I remain optimistic because these populations, just like the land they depend on, it's malleable. We can manage it. We can recover it. We can bring them back. And so we can do something to save them so that we don't lose any of these. And the important thing, I think, for us to keep in mind at this time of the year is these birds are flying back from, many of them, from tropical areas in Central and Northern South America, making journeys of thousands of miles, and they're becoming a little bit more hazardous and treacherous for these birds. And while they head to the tropics to at least hold over while we're locked in winter, this is where they come to raise their young. They do not nest in the tropics. We're responsible for providing that habitat for them to rear their young and maintain their numbers. We've got to take care of them, and so do our colleagues down in Central America, South America, to be able to give them habitat to overwinter and survive so that they can sit it out and then come back again. So we've all got to be responsible for it. As I say, I think the land is quite malleable. We can use it or abuse it. We can do things that can certainly cause some tremendous harm for wildlife, but we can also rectify it. And the one thing I always remind people of, there are a lot of environmental problems out there, and we are the primary cause of all of them. Yeah. The good news is we're also the solution.
David, thank you again for calling. Yeah, that managed forest land law is a great law. And the Master Naturalist program, a great...
Oh, it's great. Yeah, for people who just have a casual curiosity, it's nice to be able to sit down with experts and be able to sort this out and become more familiar and answer some of these questions and mysteries of what's going on in nature, and gets you to look a lot closer.
David, thanks again. Let's turn to Jill in Whitewater next. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a problem with a robin this year, which is a very strange thing. I have a closed, enclosed porch that's attached to my house, and I prop my door open, my screen door open, for my Bernese Mountain Dogs to be able to go out to the fenced-in yard behind my house. A robin has decided he wants to make a nest on top of the screen door when it's open, and it's been going on for over a month now. And I continually am... and sadly, having to take it, what he's building, down so I can close my door. But he's back as soon as I open it up again, and I just don't know what to do about him. He, in fact, has flown into my home, made a U-turn so he can get back out into the yard again.
Hmm.
Well, robins like to build in, say, a crotch of a tree, a large limb of a tree. They'll start with that mud base and then line it with the grasses. Or on top of, say, as in your case, a screen door or a light fixture. And sometimes they're in a place we just don't want them, especially, say, a light fixture right by the front door. What you want to do is try to discourage them early, some sort of a physical obstruction so that they cannot begin to nest on that area. And you might want to somehow give them an alternative, a shelf that's under, say, the soffit on the north side of a house or far distant, or, you know, certainly good shade trees. If you can discourage them early enough, they'll usually seek something else, realize, well, this is not the place I'm welcome, and give them that alternative space somewhere else. This is the best I could offer for you.
There you go, Jill. Thank you. David in La Crosse, your turn. Hi, David.
Hi, good afternoon. I visit Key West, Florida once a year for the last 12 years, and I'll be real quick with my question. There's mockingbirds down there, and I know they probably teach each other the songs as their children when they grow up, But how does a mockingbird in Key West, Florida know exactly what a red-winged blackbird sounds like in southern Wisconsin?
Mm-hmm. Well, mockingbirds are common in the eastern U.S. We're a little bit to the north and the west of their range, but we do get occasionally a couple of strays that will come here. There have been a few nest records for Wisconsin, so it's always an exciting one for us because we're out of the normal range. And the name mockingbird is because they're in the family of what are literally called the mimics. The family name is Mimidae. And they will take then other birds' songs and voices and put that into that whole long rolling vocal repertoire of theirs. And so we recognize the catbird, the brown thrasher, and the mockingbird. All of those are the mimics. More by the pattern of the song than it is by the actual voice, because they'll mimic a lot of other birds. I've heard brown thrashers do about 3, 4, 5 different bird songs in their one long rolling song. So, yeah, they'll kind of pick up. They're good mimics and imitators. Whatever they hear, they'll pick that up and roll it in. And maybe they're even picking that up from other birds. And it's like, hey, he's got a good one there. I'll try that too. So, yeah, it's a bird that we recognize by the pattern. And, yeah, they're really interesting that they'll do that imitation of so many other bird songs.
Speaking of songs, Kenneth in Janesville called. He got a canary for his birthday, and it doesn't sing. And he wants to know what he could do to encourage it to sing.
Oh, I'm not good on cage birds and pet birds. So I guess I'm the wrong person to ask there. Probably the pet store specialists would be the ones to check on that. I've never kept cage birds, and so I don't have any experience in that one. I'm sorry.
A listener called to ask if you can comment on the effect of electromagnetic fields disrupting migration.
Well, we've known for a while that birds seem to, and it's not necessarily all the species, but some birds seem to have a sensitivity to electromagnetic fields to help them in migration. There was an old experiment back in, I think it was like the 1940s, where they took homing pigeons, they drove them 500 miles away from where they were from, never been to this place, and assuming that electromagnetic fields may have something to do with their ability to home, they took one group and put a little brass plate on top of their head just so they had a weight. Another one, they put magnet on. The ones with the brass plates seemed to find their way home, and the others got confused and lost, and it seemed to interfere with that ability. But, of course, migration isn't just electromagnetic fields. Birds will be flying in the evening for most of our species. A good south wind pushes them north. They'll be using migratory corridors, Lake Michigan shore, the Mississippi River, so the geography is certainly important. They'll also navigate by the stars. And so there's multiple environmental cues that help them to find their way. And so if you're relying on the stars and it's a cloudy night, well, you have to have a fallback plan. So we know that from experiments that birds are sensitive to a number of different environmental cues to help find their way. It still remains a mystery of how they put that together in their head to make sense of it and actually use it for navigation. And to me, that's still the wonder of migration, that birds can literally go thousands of miles every year, twice a year, back and forth, and almost unerringly find their way. It's one of the great things about birds is this mystery of migration.
Jan emailed, she has seen 5 dead pelicans along the Rock River in Janesville, and I guess the DNR has been contacted about it. Avian flu is suspected.
Yeah, unless we finally get them into the laboratory and do the what we call necropsy, which is the animal version of an autopsy, it's guesswork. So, yeah, we'll have to take a look at just what the actual cause of death is. So, yeah, collecting that a few carcasses and actually doing that analysis will tell us what the problem is. If it is something that is potentially epidemic, then we'll have to come up with a plan to find a way to disperse those birds so they're not spreading it more and more among the population. And so, yeah, this is a part of wildlife management is monitoring bird health and then trying to do something about it to make sure that we kind of break that cycle.
Yeah. Ellie in Madison called to ask how large eagle nests get.
Well, they like to add a little something every year, and those that are used year after year do get bigger and bigger. There was a report of one in Florida. It's kind of the world record. It was something like 20 feet high and was well over a ton, and eventually brought down a large limb. It was probably exceptional that you had a few generations of eagles that kept going back to this site. So, on average, eagle nests would be, say, about 3 feet across and maybe 2-3 feet high. But those that are used year after year, they certainly can get a little bit larger. Oftentimes, they'll be built on an open, exposed limb, which may eventually then fall from the tree and then have to find an alternate site. So there may be sort of a lifespan for that nesting site. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps them from getting be too large. But in some cases, even the nest itself may bring down the limb.
A listener emailed to ask if loons usually sit on decks. He saw one and was very surprised to see the loon on his deck.
I would be surprised, too. Loons don't really walk well. Their legs are set so far back on the body, which is excellent for paddling and diving to some great depths, but they are very clumsy on land. They actually sort of slide onto their nest site, which is why they're little floating islands. So, I would be very surprised if they're very far from water whatsoever.
Norm from O'Connell Falls, this goes back to the gal who called about the flute-sounding bird. Wonder mm-hmm. if it might be a fox sparrow.
Fox sparrow is it's very musical. It's got somewhat, to at least to my ear, a bit of a pattern. It begins like a song sparrow. It's a nice, clear, little rolling whistle. I don't think of it as being quite so bubbly and rolling as we think of as the flute music, but that's another possibility.
Yeah, we've
and
got
here's always the problem is how do we describe, those sounds that we're hearing? Since we can't imitate them, it's really hard to put it into words sometimes.
And I think Tyler's got a fox sparrow. Pretty song.
Yes, it's quite musical, but I think it's a little bit more of a clear whistle than what I would describe as flute-like. But it does have a little bit of that rolling to it and very melodic.
And John in Boyceville was wondering how meadowlarks are doing.
Well, these are birds like bobolinks of the open fields, and these were birds originally associated with prairies. And as a lot of the prairies were converted to farmland, they actually did quite well for a while during that era when we were pasturing cattle. So we still had that residual growth out there, and the birds could use then from what were the original prairies to sort of a man-made open grassland, the pasture lands. The problem has been that over the decades, we've confined the cows. We've taken that, converted it to clover crops, which are harvested quite early, and usually around Memorial Day, you'll see the first hay cutting. And that is just as these birds are arriving, they're just beginning to nest, and then these sites are mowed. And that ends up to a tremendous mortality of the nest and a lack of nesting success. And if they're not replacing themselves, then as those older birds are dying out, populations go down. And, we have seen a reduction over the last, three, 4 decades of meadowlarks and bobolinks. That's why it's important to maintain these permanent grasslands in CRP. And if you do have a hay field, don't mow it until at least July.
And on that note, we are out of time, Bill. I'm so sorry, but you'll be back and we'll do this again. Bill Volkert, a naturalist and wildlife educator, and he will be back. And thank you all. Melinda Myers joins us tomorrow for Garden Talk. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots in store.